Those are the voices of Baltimore demonstrators calling for an end to police brutality. The shooting death of the unarmed black teenager Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri last summer reignited tensions between law enforcement and citizens. This is Dan Rodericks. On this Martin Luther King Day, on midday, we look back on Ferguson and at the protests that followed and ask, what now? Where do we go from here? Lessons from Ferguson, a conversation about race, criminal justice, and law enforcement on midday, coming up after the news from NPR. Sound from a variety of demonstrations held in and around Baltimore in response to the August shooting death of unarmed black teenager Michael Brown down in Ferguson, Missouri, and the decision not to indict a police officer in his death. Of course, a lot has happened since Michael Brown's death. We're going to talk about it and reflect on it in this hour of the show. Dan Rodericks here. This is Midday. Thanks again for joining us. More protests, of course, followed in December when a grand jury declined to indict the New York City police officer responsible for the chokehold death of Eric Garner, another unarmed black man up on Staten Island. Since those deaths, many questions have been raised about law enforcement's use of excessive force. In Baltimore, demonstrators have held countless rallies calling for an end to police brutality and misconduct. In fact, the Justice Department is in the midst of reviewing the Baltimore Police Department and accusations of police brutality. A recent series in the Baltimore Sun revealed that the city has paid millions of dollars to resolve civil suits alleging police brutality and other misconduct since 2011. But overall, the events that transpired after Ferguson have refocused our collective attention on race, police, and criminal justice in this country. So today, Martin Luther King Day, the holiday, we thought we'd reflect on American race relations post-Ferguson and ask these questions of you, our listeners, and our guests today. What now? Where do we go from here? What's the lesson from all of this? What's the upshot going to be? What might be gained from these protests and demonstrations? With us to discuss this is American culture commentator Sherry Parks, who is Associate Dean in the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park and joins us once a month for her take on American culture. Nice to have you with us again, Sherry.
Thank you.
And also with us, civil rights historian, law professor Larry Gibson, and author of a biography of Thurgood Marshall. Larry Gibson, it's nice to have you back on Midday with us.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us by phone is the Reverend Courtley C.D. Witherspoon. Reverend Witherspoon is the president of the Baltimore chapter of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and he's a local proponent of criminal justice reform and has taken part in many of the demonstrations. And it's nice to have you with us, Elder Witherspoon.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And let me start with Sherry Parks, and then we'll hear from Larry, and then C.D. Witherspoon. We haven't talked about this now. You were on the show maybe a month ago, a little more, talking about this with us. Yeah, what are your reflections on this, and how would you answer my question? What do you think comes of this? Where do we go from here?
Well, I think this is a catalytic moment. I mean, we've been reflecting on how this is different than moments in the 60s. And I think what is different is that now there are at least two factors. And I think during the hour, we'll probably talk about it a lot more. Now there are African-Americans with enough voice and power to propel the argument in ways that we couldn't in the 60s. And while there was certainly non-blacks who were involved in the earlier movements, there are many more now. And I think the middle-of-the-road white person of good heart is concerned, and that's new. So the silences have been broken, and once that silence has been broken, although American culture has this amazing ability to self-heal, I think this time it's not going to be so easy to go back to the status quo.
Hmm. Larry Gibson, what are your thoughts on all this? I know it's a lot that's transpired since August and the death of Michael Brown, but your thoughts today?
Well, what is new is technology, and technology that now shows in a fairly indisputable way that all too often what has been happening for many years leading to violent confrontations as is, have occurred as a result of escalation by police officers. That has been what many people have said and black people have said for an awful long time. But with video now, that's becoming clear that that is what is happening. I mean, Eric Garner is clearly a situation where this man did not want a violent confrontation. It was the police officers who should be the one de-escalating who escalated. And I think, will bring about some change, because I think that what people are saying is, they sometimes use the word training, but what it really means is that the expectation must be that the law enforcement person, the professional, has the principal responsibility to try to diffuse the situations of confrontations and to not let them escalate. And too often, the exact opposite is happening. Keep in mind that the citizen who's involved in such a confrontation, it's usually a situation where they are in fear. They're afraid of the officer. It's something, a situation which they're not familiar. Whereas the police officer has been trained supposedly to deal with situations, has superior equipment, has a gun, probably has a bulletproof vest, has communications equipment available, the ability to get assistance. And so they should diffuse. And far too often, they do just the opposite.
I would take your comment about technology one step further and mention where we are today in the digital age and with social media and the way word travels. And C.D. Witherspoon, I know you could speak to that, because that's one of the tools that are used by people who become active and vigilant and want to see change.
Absolutely. You are exactly correct. You know, one of the things I remember is when Kamani Gray was killed by the police in New York. Non-traditional forms of media was on the ground, and they were able to get out the information in a way that mainstream media was not able to. So certainly technology is a tool that we use to get the word out, and I think that we have seen an emergence of that type of thing as so far as these cases are concerned. It's projected a brand new light on this very old and ancient issue.
Where do you think we go from here, though? We've had the protests, we've been through these incidents, we've seen what's happened, two grand juries declining to indict police officers, and the protests continue, right, through the weekend, even today. What's the takeaway? Where do we go from here?
Well, I think that we definitely, I think the conversation and the dialogue is good, and I think it's healthy to be had. I think that we have to build on our strengths and our unity, because what we are seeing is I've said just the other day, we're seeing black people standing beside white people. We're seeing rich people standing beside poor people. We're seeing people who have taken positions against police brutality standing beside people who fight for workers' rights. And I think what we do is we recognize the poor relationship between these issues and recognize that we're dealing certainly with racism, but also with class issues as well. So I think we have to continue the dialogue, and I also think that we have to push for political advantages as well. We've got to make sure that we get a federal piece as so far as police brutality is concerned. We need some attention paid to this particular issue from Washington, because it is a widespread issue. We've worked on campaigns from as far west as Oakland, California, to as far north as Massachusetts and Midwest and Detroit. So this is a widespread issue. We need to advocate for reform from Washington on this issue.
Sherry Parks, Larry, did you want to say something about follow up on CD? Okay. It doesn't matter, either one of you.
Okay, I'll follow up a bit. I think this moment is a call to action for middle-class black people. I think there had been a schism, a growing schism between working-class black people mm-hmm. and middle-class black people, and I see this coming together. I run a program, Social Innovation Scholars, where students research a topic and then devise an intellectually based intervention. This year, it runs the calendar year, this year a third of them are working on Ferguson-related topics. And I think that's the next step. There's a real, the protests are important to draw attention and to show we're not going away. But at the same time, there's a rear guard of people who are beginning to strategize in new ways and learn how to strategize.
Are they black and white students?
Yes.
Larry, what do you want to say?
Yep.
There were two points that Reverend Witherspoon made that I'd like to emphasize. One, he said that this is a long-term a problem. As he was holding his demonstration earlier, I guess about a week ago, I was reminded of what I think is about the largest demonstration that was held against police brutality, certainly in the era, in Maryland. This was 1942. In 1942, 2,000 black people went down to Annapolis to protest several issues, but the most immediate matter that had led to this was a police brutality situation, very much reminiscent of what we're hearing now. What had happened was there'd been a fight between a police officer and a young Army private named Thomas Brodus. Brodus then tried to leave, and the police officer killed him and shot him in the back as he left. And 2,000 African-Americans went down to Annapolis, occupied the House chamber, and demanded a change.
Can I just mention this? Larry Gibson brought in a photograph showing this, kind of an amazing photograph that I don't think we'd even see this today in Annapolis. I'm not sure. I don't know that it would be allowed. So many
probably couldn't get into the chamber.
People, yeah, non-delegates coming into the House, citizens, all black men and women dressed up in their Sunday best, filling the chamber there. It's either the center or the House. Is that? Can you tell?
I think it's the House, yeah. But I'm not sure which chamber it is.
It's kind of a stunning photograph.
It's one of the houses in Annapolis.
And Brodus, I assume, was African-American.
He was African-American. Right. He was an African-American soldier. And there were lots of incidents of brutality directed at African-American soldiers during both world wars, but that's another matter of fact, something about of which I'm writing. So this is not a new issue. My very first real consequential trial in a civil rights matter was in 1969. There had been some allegations of police brutality and some demonstrations held in front of the Northwestern Police District on Gilmore Street, sponsored by an organization called Soul School. Well, the police arrested the leaders of the organization and accused them of inciting to riot. And I defended them. At the trial, the police officers really grossly misrepresented what had occurred. But still, this was before the age of videotape. However, it was not before the age of tape. What happened was that a WBAL-TV reporter heard about the trial. He, a former reporter, this man was out of Baltimore, a white reporter. Was so incensed by what he was hearing the police officer saying and how much they were misrepresenting what had occurred, he came back to town. He says that this was filmed. I was the reporter for the station. You should go to WBAL-TV and see if they have the film. Sure enough, they did. I played the film in court, and they were acquitted.
Holy
I
rem- cow, Larry. But what was I'm sorry, the, what year did you say this
was? 1969, I think. And it was actually a kind of end of innocence on my part in terms of whether police officers would lie, because this was just gross misrepresentation by the police officers. My point is this, that their technology, it was not video at that point, it was a 16-millimeter film, and I still have the film. But it is this new technology, the ability to have a record. And I think the reason that there have been these demonstrations and why there will be some result is that there have now been repeated video showings of different incidents that sort of document that so often the escalation that has occurred that brings it from a nonviolent, a non-lethal situation to a one in which weapons are being used is by the police officer. That poor lady who got confused driving near the White House. She right. ran something mm-hmm. and then she tried to get away. She was obviously terrified. They come and they riddle her car with bullets. I guess the beginning of the video that was Rodney King. I think that was the first mm-hmm. time the nation saw video of graphic police brutality.
And now we see a push here in Baltimore and elsewhere to put body cameras on police officers. We'll see how that goes. That may be something that gets accelerated in the wake of these incidents and the protests. We have to take our first break. We'll come back. Larry Gibson with us from the University of Maryland Law School. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland, our midday American culture commentator. C.D. Witherspoon, Reverend Witherspoon, is on the phone with us. We'll also be joined by Tawanda Jones. Tawanda Jones is the sister of the late Tyrone West, who died in July of 2013 after an altercation with Baltimore police. She's been out taking part in demonstrations, too. We'll hear a bit from her. And we'd like to hear from you. Where do we go from here? 410-662-8780 is the number for Midday. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here with Sherry Parks, Larry Gibson, and the Reverend Courtly C.D. Witherspoon on the phone. Also on the phone with us now is Tawanda Jones, the sister of the late Tyrone West, who died after an altercation with Baltimore police. And Tawanda Jones has been trying to keep her brother's case in the public eye and has also taken part in demonstrations since Ferguson and the Garner case in Staten Island. She's on the cell phone with us, so I just want to take a couple of minutes, Tawanda, to get your reflections on all of this, all that's happened here to you personally and in terms of the public, what we've seen happen since Ferguson on this Martin Luther King Day. What are your thoughts today?
My thoughts, first of all, I want to thank you for having me on the show.
Sure.
And also my thoughts is I'm just like, in a sense, kind of disgusted for the simple fact that this is a day where Dr. Martin Luther King, an honored man, a soldier, in my eye, a peacemaker, you know, who basically gave his life to change things. And in my point, things have not changed. I feel like his dream is now turning into a nightmare. You know, this was not Dr. Martin Luther King's dream, you know. And as far as my brother and the media keeps putting it, there was an altercation with him and law enforcement. No, my brother was brutally and viciously attacked and murdered. One unarmed man just driving a so-called traffic stop where he was pulled out by his dreadlocks and beat to death by even a 15 police officers. Identification, drugs, and
theft. Yeah, as I said, Tawanda, your mother called, Diane. I hope you can hear me. Tawanda, her cell service there was a little spotty. We knew that, but I'm glad we got something from her today. Sorry, she couldn't be here in the studio with us. But Diane is on the phone. Diane, Tyrone West's mother, is that correct?
Yes.
Well, thank you for calling in, Diane.
And you're quite welcome. Thank you for having us, listening to Tawanda and myself.
Yeah.
I would just like to reiterate something that Tawanda has said. This happened in Baltimore, Maryland, when my son was brutally and maliciously and viciously beaten to death between 12 to 15 police officer and a Morgan State officer. They wanted my family to believe that Tyrone died from cardiac arrhythmia. If you are traumatized, your body, with blunt force trauma, asphyxiation from all the mace, so much mace was sprayed on my son. When my son was down screaming, help, help. Does that sound like an altercation between my son and police? The police officers of Baltimore City took it upon themselves to beat my child till he was no longer screaming. He was no longer breathing. He was no longer moving. My son was dead. Even after they cuffed him, police officer Nicholas David Chapman kicked my son in the head, steel-toe boots, mind you, that they wear, continue beating my son, and he was no longer moving. No one called for assistance. No one called 911 to help my child. My child died on the streets of Baltimore City by the hands of 12 to 15 animals to beat an unarmed man, screaming to please stop beating me, and they would not stop beating my child. This is the image that my family have to live with the rest of our lives. You think we can move on? You think we can just say, it happened? Let's move on. My family is stuck. We're stuck in July 18th, 2013 with this pain that we cannot get past. These are the people that we supported supposed to protect and serve. They stood over my child and they murdered him. Tyrone's blood are on their hands. It's nothing you can say to this family less than he was murdered.
Mrs. West or Sherry Parks wanted to say something. Go right ahead.
Well, I have to say that I was at the Baltimore Ferguson town meeting and members of the West family were there. The level, I think it's really important. Thank you, Dan, for doing this. I think it's really important for people to hear the level of pain that's left. Because, I mean, we can see the images and we can think about it. We can empathize it. But until you're in the room or on the radio and you hear the level of pain that's left with a family, does this really become a personal issue?
My God.
Diane, thank you for being on the phone with us today.
But
before you go, I'm wondering, I guess others would be wondering too, we know about the ruling made by the state's attorney's office. We know about that. But what about your family? Is your family continuing to take action?
Every Wednesday, in Tyrone's honor, in his name, West Wednesday, we march. We will not let this go until we get justice. We want legislators to amend the police officer's Bill of Rights, because that's what they hid behind when they murdered Tyrone. They had over 160-something days to come back to my family and tell us that Tyrone died from cardiac arrhythmia, not blunt force trauma or asphyxiation, everything that they did to him. And they expected, the state attorney expected us to accept that and move on.
All right.
They never took.
Are you taking?
Never. It was always
Diane,
what the police said. What about our witnesses who were there? We didn't know these people. These people told us what happened to my child.
All right, Diane. I just wondered if they're taking legal action. I don't have that information at my fingertips.
I think they're trying to. The West family has been pretty smart and pretty strategic. As someone who teaches strategy, they've been pretty strategic about notice the number of facts that they have and how.
Yeah.
And they've raised, I think, a very important question. They were the first family that I had heard that raised the question of whether the police should have been drug tested. It's routine to drug test the victim, but because
or
of...
Or the suspect.
Or the suspect. Mm. It is not routine to test the police, and from what they heard about, notice she said they kept beating, that eyewitnesses have suggested that the police seem not to be able to stop. Hmm. And they've said in these cases, we need to routinely drug test the police. And I think that's a very smart and important move.
And Maryland does have one of the most extreme police protective Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
Among all of the states, both in terms of the delay in the beginning of the investigation, the period of time in which the investigation, who conducts the investigation, rather than it being one and then an appeal to the board. You've got this lower-ranking officers who make the initial determinations. It is really stacked against there being a quick and comprehensive investigation. That really should be changed.
And Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake has said she's going to Annapolis to see about getting it changed. C.D. Witherspoon, Reverend Witherspoon, a lot of pain there in those voices we just heard.
Absolutely, and I salute the West family. I first met them the day after Tyrone was killed by the Baltimore City Police Department, and he was indeed murdered by the BPD as well as by Morgan State University Police. And I salute them because that family has been very unified,
mm-hmm.
And they've been very together. They kind of sort of remind me of the family of the late Anthony Anderson, who was also murdered by the Baltimore City Police. With that being said, certainly we definitely need to make modifications and changes to the Police Officer's Bill of Rights. However, I will say this. I am not certain that in these instances that the police commissioner does not have the ability to fire. I say that because there was an instance during the administration of Commissioner Biafield where he went against the recommendation of a three-panel of police officers that recommended that officers keep their job, and Commissioner Biafield fired the officers anyway. And we're doing some research to find out exactly what kind of power the police commissioner has. I say that because, you know, in the case of Anthony Anderson, his murder was considered a homicide.
This is Anderson. This is the case at Lexington Market.
No, Anthony Anderson. Anthony Anderson was killed in East Baltimore at the corner of Montford and Biddle in 2012.
That's a different case than the
one
I was thinking
of. He was killed by the Baltimore.
Right.
The police officers walked up behind him on a grassy path on the birthday of his 2-year-old grandchild in the presence of her and his elderly mother and his children, picked him up in the air, slammed him on the head. The police officers indicated that he was in the process of committing a drug transaction. However, we demanded the autopsy report. The preliminary autopsy report came back that Mr. Anderson did not have any airway obstruction, nor was there any drugs on the scene. Witnesses came forward and said that he was not involved in a drug transaction, and the Baltimore City Police Department had to recant the initial statement that they put out indicating that he was in the midst of a drug transaction.
Is it, in cases like this, I mean, we don't have all the facts here, but I appreciate your input, Reverend Witherspoon. Larry Gibson, I mean, I know about the police officer's Bill of Rights and what the mayor and others have said about amending it because it's too protective of the police in the minds of many people.
Well,
but what do we do with all this? Do we have to include civilians in the review of charges against police officers? Should we have a special prosecutor come in and present evidence to grand juries? That's one of the things that was suggested after the decision in Ferguson and the decision in Staten Island, that our local prosecutors and police are too close, for instance.
As an evidence professor for 40-some years, I think the most dramatic change is going to be the technology, the cameras. Already it's what has, in my view, greatly added to the demand for change,
Larry,
and organizing of people.
Professor
and I think
Gibson,
it's going to happen.
You had a video tape of Eric Garner and the chokehold and still no indictment.
Well, no, but that began the process as an important part of the process of organizing and the people. I didn't say that in every situation the film would lead to a specific result, but I think it will dramatically reform the conduct of police officers with that knowledge that they're being filmed.
Let's go to the phone lines and invite our listeners into this conversation and welcome more comments from Sherry Parks, Larry Gibson from the University of Maryland Law School, and Reverend C.D. Witherspoon, who is the president of the Baltimore chapter of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Dolores, go right ahead with your comments. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I also am Tawanda Jones's aunt, Tyrone West's aunt, and I'm listening to my sister, very upset and emotional about this. We have not begun to wrap our mind around this situation. My concern is, in terms of moving forward, if you can, if we can't, justice has to prevail in this situation. But in terms of moving forward, you initially had three or four rogue cops who initiated this entire thing. And then you had the other cops standing around watching them do this. My concern is we all need policing in our community. We need cops. They are good cops. But then you have these rogue cops. If the good cops that are on the force are standing around and watching these things happen and saying nothing, they too are participating in these kinds of situations. So my concern is, where are the good cops? Small amount of policemen are causing police departments to get a black eye, and no one from the police force is speaking up. Where are the good cops? And I know there are some because they're on the streets every day, but they are letting a small amount of rogue cops have a terrible reflection on them. So my concern is to those policemen to speak up. When you see wrong, take control of this. Report it to your supervisor. Do something. Don't allow the entire force to go down the drain for a couple of rogue cops. Thank you, Dolores.
Larry Gibson.
But there is a change here in across-the-board police culture. I think that is necessary. And that is a recognition that the police officer in the encounter with the private citizen has the burden, the main responsibility of defusing it and stopping it from escalating. Of course, both parties have responsibilities, but to the average citizen, when they're confronting a police, it's an unusual event. They are frightened. They don't know what this officer's intentions are. And the police officer has all of the advantage. the weaponry, the bulletproof vest, the cameras, I mean, not the cameras, the communication system. And so rather than escalate, they should use time, use space, and affirmatively have a duty to de-escalate the situation and not convert it into a violent situation, where too often we see the police thinking that they must immediately do something using this firepower
force
that they have.
Yeah.
And the culture that Dolores alluded to, that the good police are not doing anything for the bad police, there has now been, I think, an increased perusal of police culture, the culture within. And we've been watching with the funerals in New York and the actions of the police and the mayor, this pushing of whether these marches are anti-violence or anti-police. And all of this is the culture trying to get back to business as usual, you know, to say, well, we support the police. And where the marches are never saying, notice how balanced her statement was. It was not anti-all police. It was anti-some police. And so there really is this conversation going on about, what are we talking about here? Are they anti-police? No, they're anti-police brutality.
There's one piece of standard procedure. I don't know when police got into this shoot-to-kill approach to using weaponry.
Exactly.
They have been given higher-powered police pistols. I mean, they used to have a .38, but now they have these powerful guns
to match what criminals have.
Well, but then
that's why
it seems to be this shoot to kill, no shoot to disaim. No, let's not try to how defuse. Let's not try to escalate. And I don't think it should be an automatic shoot to kill when you don't even know whether the person at which you're shooting is armed at all.
I agree there. Dave is on the line.
Tamir,
is Dave on the line? I'm sorry. I thought I heard another voice.
This is CD.
Oh, CD. I'm sorry.
Sure. If I may, I think moving forward, one of the things that I'd like to see happen is these officers being charged with first-degree murder, because there is a major, major double standard. We see persons being charged with criminal charges every single day. And I think it's egregious, quite frankly, that we have officers who are not even being charged with manslaughter for murdering unarmed African-American men. So I salute Mr. Gibson for helping to elect a new state's attorney. I hope moving forward that we begin to charge officers with first-degree murder, because we have not had that, whether it's been in Maryland or in New York or in California, or in all these other states around the country where consistently unarmed African-American men are being killed by the police. I'll say this. In Detroit, there was a young lady 2 years ago by the name of Iona Jones. She was sitting in her grandmother's living room, and an officer's bullet pierced through her skull and killed her while she was watching television, and the officer didn't even get charged with manslaughter.
What was the circumstance? Was it a shooting nearby, or did he intend to shoot her?
No. The officer busted into her home. They were looking for her father or something of that sort, and they shot her by mistake.
Mm-hmm. And it was considered accidental shooting?
I assume so.
Yeah.
But my difficulty is there were incidents where two young boys a couple years ago here in Baltimore killed a dog. They were prosecuted. They were acquitted, and they were attempted to be prosecuted again. We can't even get cops indicted for killing African-American men. I think that sends a major message.
Thank you, Courtly C.D. Witherspoon. I'll take one quick comment here before we take our next break. Dave in Baltimore, thank you for calling on this Martin Luther King Day.
Was that Dave you said?
Yes, go right ahead, Dave.
Yes, that's a great idea to put King's perspective on the events in Ferguson and elsewhere. I'm looking at King's words right now, and he said, when you respond to violence with violence, you may think you're destroying violence, but you're merely increasing violence. Violence increases hate. Hate cannot get rid of hate. Only love can do that. I worked for many years in a psychiatric hospital where I sometimes had to deal with violent patients, and we had no weapons. We just had our bare hands, and our goal was to restrain those people, not to hurt them, not to kill them. And that's not only the humane thing to do, but we knew afterwards we would have to be on the same unit with these same patients. And how useful if the police could do the same thing, that they would restrain people rather than hurt them, or in our foreign policy, we would try to restrain evil rather than killing people.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you for your comments. We'll take another break here at midday. If you'd like to join our conversation with reflections on Ferguson and where we go from here, what's the upshot of all this, give us a ring, 410-662-8780. Our toll-free long-distance number is 866-661-9309, and our email address, midday@wypr.org. Welcome back, everyone. Dan Roderick's here with Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland and WYPR Midday contributor on American culture. Larry Gibson, law professor at the University of Maryland and author of a biography on Thurgood Marshall. And the Reverend Courtly C.D. Witherspoon is with us by phone, president of the Baltimore chapter of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. You can give us a ring with your reflections post-Ferguson today, 410-662-8780. Last time we talked about this, had an open phone hour, Larry and Sherry, and a woman had called in to talk about her son, her African-American woman talking about her son and her son's relationships or experiences with police officers on the street. And I've had other guests on the show say what she said, that, you know, you go to great pains to instruct them on how to behave. I had a gentleman call in to say that, he tells his son to show his hands the whole time, and he has special instructions for a young black man encountering a police officer, white or black, on the city streets. And I made the comment that, that it's different for white people. I'm sorry, but in my experience, I've never had to instruct my son or felt a need that I was worried about my son being brutalized by police or being even pulled over by an officer for no reason other than maybe he was in the wrong place at the wrong moment, or the police officer didn't like the way he looked, or whatever. It's different for us. It's different for white people. It's a different experience. And I push back on this from white people who said, I've told my son to be polite with police officers, and that's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have the terror. I mean, black parents think about this when they give birth to a boy. And they prepare that talk with great care because they worry about the survival of their children. A white man told me a story very recently about when he came to discover this, that his white son's best friend was a black guy, and they lived within biking distance, the two houses in the same neighborhood. And the two boys for years have been biking back and forth, and they never thought much about it. But because of all of these events, the black boy began to talk to the white family about what it was like to bike to their house. On a routine basis, he stopped and harassed and asked where he's going, and he has to make sure he has his ID. They had no idea, because he was arriving at their home and not saying anything, because it was a part of his life, that people do not understand the daily fabric of black men's lives in this country. Black men live, and this is not an overstatement, in a police state, where you carry your pass papers with you all the time. You're careful to. And you know that you cannot achieve your way out of this. It doesn't matter. Driving a nice car might get you stopped more, actually. So there's no way to move past this. And it's important that's why I mentioned about white people of good heart. It's important that people who, through no fault of their own, did not know this, know this.
Thank you very much,
Larry. She's absolutely right. I mean, I raised my son, and of course, from very early age, I had to explain this phenomena to him. But I'm continuing to think just historically how long this problem has been. In his first year as a lawyer, Thurgood Marshall represented the widow of a man. His name had been Cater Stevens. He and his wife was driving, Stevens and his wife, in Bladensburg. They had a minor traffic incident. Before the evening was over, Cater Stevens was dead, shot in the back by a police officer who said that he tried to escape from the scene of this very minor accident. Thurgood Marshall pushed hard, actually, in this case, did have the police indicted. He was acquitted, but then Thurgood Marshall, in 1935, succeeded in getting a jury in Upper Marlboro, an all-white jury to give damages to the wife on account of this. My point is that this is not a new problem. What is new, fortunately, is the evidence is getting stronger because of video. We all carry video cameras now on our telephones and use them.
I meant to ask you before we go on, when you showed us, showed me anyway, the photographs from 1942
right.
of some part of the 2,000 African-American men and women from Baltimore went to Annapolis into the State House building to protest the shooting death of an unarmed black soldier.
Soldier Thomas Brodus.
Shot in the back, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know whatever came of all that? The legislators listened to them and then...
There was appointed. The major consequence of that demonstration was a governor, which is governs it a lot, appointed an interracial commission. There were no real changes in the law, but there was some reform by the Baltimore Police Department, yes. Because which gets to me the other point that Reverend Riverspoon mentioned. What is the solution? And that it is political. I hope that this organizing activity ends up with voter registration and people using what really is the main lever. Just use the moment, use the excitement. But these hundreds and these thousands of young people who are demonstrating, I hope all of them are registered voters. And if they aren't, they become. They then start selecting police commissioners.
Thank you, Larry Gibson. And let's go back to the phone lines. And Reverend Witherspoon is on the line with us. If you want to comment about what you hear from our callers, please do. Here's Lee in Timonium with a comment. Welcome to Midday, Lee.
Good afternoon. I have two comments, sort of related. A good friend of mine's next-door neighbor was one of the county police officers. And one day I was talking to him, and he made the comment, "We're the biggest gang there is." The police. I was kind of shocked by that, and I've never forgotten that, even though that was over 10 years ago. So it kind of relates to my second comment, which I believe we need better screening of people who become police. I mean, you should have a servant mentality, not think you're part of a gang. And I don't know whether he had that attitude before he joined them or not, but I think we need better screening, and I do recall reading one large European country, it took 3 years to become a policeman. I don't know exactly the details of that, but I think maybe more training and better screening.
Thank you very much.
I want to just go back to this political point. How did Thurgood Marshall in 1934 get a police officer in Bladensburg indicted? He told the local DA, his man's name was Bowie, Robert Bowie, who was up for re-election, that if you will do right here, I will urge black folks down there to vote for his re-election. And that's exactly what happened. He cut a political deal with that local prosecutor, and that's exactly what happened there. This is in 1934. Use the political power. Yes, use the demonstration, but ultimately we're talking about the law, and the way to change law is by elections and voting.
I think both of you are making the point that this is a very complex problem. Police have very complex jobs. They need to understand culture. They need to understand race. They need to understand social class. They need to understand symbolic interactionism. What does it mean when somebody moves their body this way? Not what just you think it means, what the research. And I think a better educated police force is part of the issue. And more involved electorate is part of the solution.
Let's go to Sally in Baltimore. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I do agree with everything that's been said so far about the overkill and the zealousness of the police recently. And of course, we can go all the way back to lynching and realize that problems have existed forever. But what's going on now is, why do you have to shoot somebody 10 times from head to toe to stop them? Why can't police officers be trained to go for the waist down? If you're really trying to stop a person from running away, does it help to hit them in the head? And I don't understand why they're not better marksmen in the police force if they're going to be given these guns that can, I gather they're like machine guns, that can completely rip a body to pieces. And I think part of our problem is many faceted problem. Part of the problem is that I've worked in civil rights all my life, so I've known people of every culture. But I don't think we have a very integrated society, so we don't have much respect or compassion for each other. And we, being the white people who are in the majority, don't understand what it is like to be fearful of the police. And I can guarantee if there were a ruckus in front of Roland Park Public School, which is integrated, you would not have white, tall white boys shot to pieces.
Thank you, Sally. Can I take April's comment? Because it follows along there, and then we'll hear from Sherry. Go ahead, April, follow right along. Let's hear from you,
Hi.
Too. Yep.
Hi. I just kind of wanted to piggyback on this conversation about education. I personally believe that racism and systematic racism could probably be improved if everybody were a little bit better educated. And I'm wondering, like, about police, every other profession in which you're responsible for somebody's life pretty much requires a person going to college and receiving degrees, if not multiple degrees, doctors, lawyers for depending on people's freedom. I just don't understand why police, being a public servants who do not have are not required to have degrees and multiple degrees. I think that a lot of situations that people came from, like, you know, almost like sociology or psychology backgrounds would be needed for police to interact with people and understand people in order to help control them and protect them.
Thank you, April. Sherry.
Well, I think we've got to change how we think about the police. Is it their job to protect us from bad guys, or is it really public safety? Because that makes it a different question. To prevent crime, to prevent harm, as opposed to come in and shoot people after they've done it. And I think April and Sally changed that question around. I think it's really important to understand that this is not just about black people, because if you look at the history of the treatment of black people in this culture, often we are the canaries in the mine. People from the Occupy movement found that if you end up on the wrong side of the police, you get treated like a black person. And so often that the behavior comes first with black people, but then other groups follow because that pattern has been set. Those laws, those rules have been set. And other minority groups have found this. Latinos have found it more recently. Asians found it when they began to get critical masses. And even white students have found it when they ended up on the wrong side of the law. So it actually should matter to everybody.
Sherry, go right ahead. CD? Yep, go right ahead.
Yes, if I may. One thing. Education is important. A public awareness is important. But we also need officers to come from the neighborhoods where they patrol. We have a lot of officers who do not live in Baltimore who patrol our streets. And there is a culture curve that these officers have not been introduced to prior to coming and joining the force. And I think that they are responsible for patrolling neighborhoods where they don't know the dynamics. They don't know the community leaders in the neighborhood. They don't know what makes the mechanics of the communities and what makes the neighborhoods work. So I think education is important, but we need to have officers who know the community.
Thank you very much. Reverend Courtly C.D. Witherspoon is president of the Baltimore chapter of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
If you're interested in hearing further discussion about the events that unfolded after Michael Brown's death in Ferguson and this past fall and into the winter, you can attend a roundtable discussion today, a continuation of what we started here on Midday, 3 p.m. today at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum in Baltimore. The event features a number of speakers, including the Police Commissioner of Baltimore, Anthony Batts, and City Councilman Nick Mosby will be there, too. More information at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum website. Larry Gibson, biographer of Thurgood Marshall, professor at the University of Maryland Law School. Thank you so much for being with us today, for your thoughts on this. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
And Sherry Parks, always a pleasure to have you on Midday. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning into our first hour. We'll take a break for lunch, brought to us today by Rosina Gourmet since 1999. Rosina Gourmet has served handmade, locally sourced ingredients for their sandwiches, soups, salads, and vegetarian items. You can find them in Canton, downtown Baltimore, Harbor East, and catering is available. Go to rosinagourmet.com.